This is Radio Freethinker, episode 100.
I'd like to start, if I may, with Professor Hawking. How did the universe start? With a big bang?
We observe that distant galaxies are moving away from us. They must have been closer together in the past. It was the beginning of the universe, and a time it's...
The complexity of life. We're not normally equipped to understand, but science gives it to us. Science is opening your eyes to the wonderfulness of what's there. Science is opening your eyes to the poetry of the expanding universe.
To come to you, Carl Sagan, could you help me by putting into layman's terms what was involved with this Big Bang?
The early cosmos was everywhere, white hot. But as time passed, the radiation expanded and pulled. Then little pockets of gas began to grow, steadily brightening. We call them the galaxies.
It was the beginning of the universe, and of time itself.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, episode 100. Yes, Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also heard on CFBX in Kamloops and on podcasts the world over. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, who will every so often come across like this because my voice is gone and I apologize. So most of the show, I'm going to try going like this because I think I sound okay. Can you hear me, Ethan?
You sound fine.
Okay.
Just like National Public Radio whispering into the mic.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Ethan, last week we talked about Marketplace, and they had a really good episode a little while ago about homeopathy. And they just did a recent episode about water purification systems. And as a good skeptic, I noticed they did kind of a bad thing and a good thing. They pointed out that there was a little scam where they would do this test and it would precipitate out minerals that were in the... They precipitated out minerals that were in the water. And, you know, they said, it's a scam because all this does is they're natural minerals that are in there and it precipitated them out. It's a big scam. But one of the things they didn't actually cover was, are all those minerals good for you? Because we do know in some places, like Love Canal, that you can have chemicals naturally dissolved into the water that are not that good for you. And they just sort of assumed that because it was a precipitate in the water, it was automatically good for you. So they kind of did half the skeptic thing, but not the full skeptic thing. And I just, you know, I'm sure 99.9% of the water in the world, or at least in Canada, is really safe and really clean. But they did this little precipitation test. I said, you know, you almost went all the way, but you didn't quite finish it. And they also had a thing about chlorination, you know, and they said, well, if we didn't chlorinate any water, we'd die of diseases, right? Because they say, oh, chlorine's in the water, you know how bad chlorine is. But they also didn't say, well, that's only in the filtration systems. Once it's in your house, if you filtered out all of the chlorine from your water, that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing once it's in your house. So again, they did a good job and they revealed some really good scams. But just to show you that even people who are sort of on your side, just keep a little skeptic eye and say, hey, what about this and what about that? Usually it'll be nothing, but always be open.
Absolutely. And I think Marketplace is the kind of show where they would actually really appreciate that kind of feedback. From what we've met other producers and their hosts, they're pretty self-skeptical too, and they definitely want their audience to call them on anything that they missed.
And that's the difference between constructive criticism versus just blind denial, which you were getting from the homeopathy in their previous episodes.
Absolutely. Well, you know, today is our 100th episode. What a thrill. I honestly did not think we'd make it to 100. I was pretty sure we'd hit like 30 and then we'd be tossed out on the street. But here we are, 100, and we've got a really fantastic show today to talk about. We have everything from a new tricorder being developed here at UBC to new archaeological discoveries to climate change stories and a big discussion on science and imperialism. We're also going to debuting a new recurring segment here on Radio Freethinker called Argument Clinic, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But on the top of the show, let's discuss this tricorder. This is a new medical invention.
Oh, no, you don't have to tell me. I've watched Star Trek, so tricorder is one of those little things that go, woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo. Oh, God, does that sound horrible? woo-woo. And they can tell you everything about you from your quantum state all the way up to where your great-great ancestors were born a billion years ago. Right? Right? Is it that kind of tricorder?
It's almost that kind of tricorder. That's like if you took an iPhone and put it on this tricorder. This is actually a really neat medical device, and it's actually turning quite a few heads. And best of all, it originated here in Vancouver at UBC. In fact, when UBC experts were asked to identify advances that might transform the world for 2011, for the January issue of the UBC Reports, this new device was at the top of their list. The invention is a handheld device that will help doctors diagnose sick patients in a quick test that identifies the virus the patient is carrying by separating human DNA from virus DNA. Normally, separating DNA from a virus from a human is very time-consuming and very difficult. But the lead researcher, Andre Mazzarelli, a physics professor here at University of British Columbia, has suggested that it's sort of like looking for a needle in a haystack. And his team hoped this new tricorder, quote-unquote, it's probably not really called a tricorder, it's actually a portable battery-powered device. We'll be able to pinpoint specific DNA signatures of a virus, and that will have a huge benefit to the medical community.
How sensitive is this device?
Well, apparently it's quite useful here. Lead researcher went on to say that you often can't identify a virus that are infecting someone because of the amount of human DNA in the background. Fortunately, this device can pick out specific DNA sequences for analysis, which he says this is huge. We have an incredible ability to reject background DNA. So normally what they would do is they take throat swabs or blood samples, and then you'd have to send them to a lab for, you know, a week or two, whereas this can do a scan in real time with a throat swab or a blood sample. The technology will also be a huge benefit during flu season because, as we know, there are usually a couple of different strains that go around, and sometimes figuring out what the strain that the patient has is a difference between saving their life and not saving their life. So this technology can quickly identify which flu virus they have, and that's pretty darn impressive when you think about it.
So I'm confused. Does it sit there and just filter out the human DNA, or does it actually look for the virus DNA?
I think it does both. I was reading a little bit on how it works, but it kind of went above my head. From what I understand, it uses a very small electric current, which causes the DNA to sort of straighten out, which makes it easy to spot, I guess. Actually, you know, this is probably something that one of our medical listeners might be able to research for us and let us know how accurately we're telling the story here. But it's quite exciting.
And sounds cool.
It's very cool. I love cool science. But, you know, speaking of cool science.
Well, actually, that was probably a horrible way to introduce it, because this isn't cool. In 2010, apparently, according to the UN, is the worst year for disasters. Almost 300,000 people died, according to the UN, last year in natural disasters. Of course, Haiti was the big one. It accounted for about a little over 222,000. But in that was also the Russian heat wave, which accounted for over 55,000 people dying, and the economic loss of over 373 major disasters that were recorded in 2010, which makes it the worst ever, reached over $109 billion. And some of those economic losses included floods and landslides in China that caused an estimated $18 billion in damage. There were the floods in Pakistan that were almost $10 billion. Now, this ties in with another story that I was reading about how the rise in flood claims in Canada are tied to climate change. Canadian insurance companies apparently are facing an unprecedented growth in claims and payouts for water-related home damage, industry experts are blaming essentially climate change. In 2009, the insurance companies paid out nationally, this is in Canada, a little over $5 billion, and over half of them went for extreme weather events. According to the Insurance Bureau of Canada, fire damage was the most expensive cost for insurance companies until 2005, when it was surpassed by extreme weather events. A new reality of climate change means heavy rains and extreme weather. Right now, the eastern seaboard in central North America are bracing themselves for a huge snowstorm that's just going to blanket the area. Unprecedented amount of moisture in the air, thanks to things like climate change. Many people have heard that 2010 tied as the hottest year on record, but not as many people remember that it was also the wettest year on record. Again, the warmer the environment gets, the more its carrying capacity is for water. Now, as for the science of everything, the increasing severity of extreme rain events just makes climate change more undeniable, according to scientific experts. I mean, we're beating a dead drum, but I was watching, what was it, Real Time with Bill Maher.
I saw that too.
And they had, you know, Republican congressmen.
And Kim Campbell.
And, you know, I don't like conservatives in general. Like, that's a surprise to anyone who listens to her show. But I was so proud of her on that show because they had an American conservative from the Republican Party, and we had a Canadian conservative. And although the Canadian conservative might have its problems, she wasn't nuts like the Republican. I mean, not only did he not believe in climate change, but they were talking about evolution. And she came on and she brought up, do you believe in antibodies and vaccinations? And he said, well, yes. He said, well, that's evolution. Yeah. She actually did quite a good job.
Yeah. I mean, it was really ridiculous how the American Republicans were conflating weather with climate change. And I mean, it goes to show you that the climate change is an important distinction from this notion that it's only going to get hotter and hotter and hotter. As you mentioned, you had the Russian summer, but you're also going to face super storms like the one that Atlantic Canada is bracing for. You're going to get extreme weather regardless. It's not just going to be all hot or all cold.
And it points out, too, that the area that's going to suffer the most as far as the warming goes is actually places like the Arctic and Antarctica, where there's not a lot of people and they're not going to notice it as much, where the rest of us are going to notice it a lot are changing patterns of weather, and in particular rainfall. So, you know, places that didn't get a lot of rainfall before will actually start getting more, and those that had a lot will start getting less. And the intensity, I mean, that's the big thing, is the intensity will increase. I mean, I'm not looking forward to the next hurricane season. Because, you know, every year it's going to get just, it's going to ratchet up a little bit, hopefully not that noticeably, but, you know, 20 years from now, people are going to say, oh, I remember a hurricane and we used to sit through it. Now, you know, it wipes out the entire planet. Or not, that's a movie plot, but.
Yeah, or I think an Onion article. Why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? When we come back, we'll show our new segment, Argument Clinic, right after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Here on Radio Free Thinker, we often talk about things called logical fallacies in terms of argument and rhetoric. But if you're not an expert with these terms, this segment is for you. This is Radio Free Thinker Argument Clinic.
Yes, it is. An argument is a collective series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
You've probably heard us mention something called a straw man argument, or that someone is straw manning. This is a logical fallacy where someone takes a normally very established argument or theory and intentionally and often dishonestly portrays it in an inaccurate way for the purpose of characterizing it as incorrect. Typically, a strawman argument is done so that you can demolish it in an attempt to make your own flimsy logic seem more impressive. Some examples of strawman tactics include presenting a misrepresentation of the opponent's position and then refuting it, thus giving the appearance that the opponent's actual position has been refuted. Quoting an opponent's words out of context, i.e. choosing quotations that misrepresent the opponent's actual intentions. Presenting someone who defends a position poorly as the defender, then refuting that person's arguments, thus giving the appearance that every upholder of that position, and thus the position itself, has been defeated. Inventing a fictitious persona with actions or beliefs which are then criticized, implying that the person represents a group of whom the speaker is critical. Oversimplifying an opponent's argument, then attacking this oversimplified version. This is a frequent occurrence at creationist lectures and debates where evolution is misrepresented as an unsuccessful and unsupported idea, rather than a well-defined and repeatedly confirmed scientific theory. In summation, a straw man is arguing against a position which you create specifically to be easy to argue against, rather than the position actually held by those who oppose your point of view. This was Radio Free Thinker, Argument Clinic.
Now let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. I hope you liked Argument Clinic.
You know, I don't understand why you were trying to promote homeopathy in that. I mean, you sat there and you used the example, and obviously you were just trying to promote that particular issue. Mm-hmm. Or am I strawmanning you now?
Well, see, that's more like a false dichotomy, I think. But we'll get to that perhaps in a later Argument Clinic. Right now, we have an interesting news story that has archaeologists going, wow. They frequently say, wow. They are rethinking early human migration of Africa as an incredible find of stone tools has been discovered beneath a collapsed rock shelter in southern Arabia. The collection of hand axes and other tools shaped to cut, pierce, and scrape bear the hallmarks of early human workmanship. But they date from 125,000 years ago, which is around 55,000 years before ancestors were thought to have left the continent. This find is prompting many to push back the date humans began to leave Africa. The artifacts were uncovered in the United Arab Emirates, pointing to a much earlier dispersal of ancient humans. What is being suggested is that they probably cut across the Horn of Africa to the Arabian Peninsula via a shallow channel in the Red Sea that became passable at the end of an ice age. Once established, these early pioneers may have pushed across the Persian Gulf, perhaps reaching as far as India, Indonesia, and eventually Australia. What's leading researchers to assume that these are our ancestors who evolved in Africa about 200,000 years ago is that the array of tools included contain remarkable similarities to those fashioned by early humans in East Africa. The researchers tentatively have ruled out the possibility that other hominins have made these tools. They're, like I said, saying, okay, well, the Neanderthals that already occupied Europe and Asia were not in Arabia at this time. Now, of course, not all are convinced. Many say that there isn't enough evidence to go on that these were created by human ancestors or that they were African in origin. Now, I think what this story ultimately points to, as well as the other recent discoveries that have been made regarding early hominids, is that the story of human migration out of Africa wasn't as clear-cut as once thought. This wasn't just a logical progression from point A to point B, but rather a series of migrations going forward and back, mixing with other groups, fusing new technologies, new cultures, and new ideas. We know that there were more than just early humans and Neanderthals wandering the Earth at this time. There was actually a diverse and distinct species, and they all had contact with each other. Now, sometimes this contact included trade and interbreeding. Other times it involved conflict. So the idea that, you know, human beings were evolving in relative isolation, I think, is slowly being broken down by the constant stream of discoveries being made about archaeology. Further, exploration of our own genetic code has brought some incredible realizations. The notion that we interbred with many of our early hominid neighbors is, I think, enlightening, that, in fact, contact was regular, frequent, and in many cases not always hostile, although it may very well have been in some cases. The discoveries of stone tools like this story really, I think, make this an exciting field, so that our technology is advancing to the point where we're able to uncover our own hidden past. Ultimately, for me, I love stories of archaeology, but for me, the greatest thrill is this notion that our past is so within our grasp to understand. It's not something that we have to, you know, use guesswork about. We can actually uncover hard scientific evidence, whether it's stone tools or delving into our DNA. I mean, who knows, maybe someday we'll actually find a Neanderthal encased in ice or something, like the woolly mammoth that's been uncovered. And, you know, just really exciting.
I think they did. Isn't that the caveman in Encino? I saw a movie about that. Billy Shore or something.
Yeah. Well, if we find him, we'll just keep him in ice. But, you know...
No, actually, I think one of the things that I thought was interesting about this, again, expanding the possibilities. We had always assumed that when people left Africa, that they had to go through sort of the Sinai kind of area, you know, Egypt and all that. Well, this shows that there's another route for them to have gone along the Horn of East Africa, which is good.
Sure.
You know, and from what I was reading, one of the things they said, too, it's not like it was necessarily, you know, they went and then they kept going. They could have went out, you know, to the Arabian Peninsula, moved back, depending on the climate, you know, and the next time they went a little further and they, you know, this might have just been one stepping stone on a longer move to explore the world.
Exactly. They might have moved out for a little while, a few generations. They might have interacted with some of their hominid neighbors. They might have moved back. I mean, this is how ideas and the memes of that time were spreading around. So just really fascinating information here.
And one of the things, too, that I heard that I thought was interesting or important, you know, there's no bones found here. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why is the tools are actually very hard rocks. I mean, they're very, and they last a really long time. So in areas where bones wouldn't fossilize, these stone tools will survive, which is why, you know, it's sort of secondary or inferential information, but it's still valid, and there's a good reason why bones may not have survived in the same area. Because, I mean, they're always saying, well, you got the tools, but it doesn't prove people were there. Maybe it was aliens.
It could have been aliens, but if they were aliens, they were very primitive aliens. You know, the other thing that they pointed out was that this area of Arabia was volatile geographically as well. If there are other remains, they could easily be buried. They could have been destroyed by the shifting geography as well.
Well, and we assume too that the land now, it was the same then, but again, climate change in a slower progression and not so rapid as we're doing it now has occurred, and that, as you mentioned, the sea levels got to be quite low for certain periods of time, and the area of Arabia wasn't the desert that we think of it today. So, I mean, it's not like people could not have survived there. It was a very different habitat, especially in these, you know, sort of prairie expanses that would have been exposed during periods of low ocean levels.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure another interesting story for our listeners. And this one, I imagine, is actually very high on the list of priorities for Egypt right now, he says sarcastically. But Germany has refused to give a famous bust of Queen Nefertiti back to Egypt.
They have her, what?
A bust.
Can you say that on radio? Isn't that dirty?
No, I don't think so. It better not be.
Oh, okay.
Unlike what perhaps Don is thinking of, I'm referring to a small statue, perhaps one of the most famous of the ones of Queen Nefertiti. It is over 3,400 years old, and it has been held by Germany for since its discovery. Egypt's Supreme Council of Antiquities recently sent a request to the Prussian Cultural Heritage Foundation, which runs the Neuss Museum in the German capital where the bust is kept. Egypt's antiquities chief, Zahi Hawass, appealed to the foundation seeking the return of the bust. It's famed for its almond-shaped eyes and swan-like neck. Very beautiful. However, the foundation said it did not consider the letter an official state request, as it had not been signed by the Egyptian Prime Minister Ahmed Nazif. Now, the Nefertiti bust was found in December 6th of 1912 at Armenia by the German Oriental Company, led by German archaeologist Ludwig Borchardt, and it was found in what had been the sculptor Tumos' workshop, along with some other unfinished busts of Nefertiti. So there's some dispute over how this document was acquired by Germany.
I had to laugh when you said Prussian, because we know from cultural stereotypes, Prussians are very exact. It must be done this way or else. So the paperwork being the snafu shouldn't really have surprised anyone.
Yeah.
But we were talking before about the idea of ownership. And I mean, you know, it was found in Egypt. Historically, I guess the Egyptians could make a claim, but Nefertiti herself is not the same kind of Egyptian that are the current Egyptians, right? I mean, there's been so much immigration and migration that the current stock of Egyptians are probably quite different than what were the genetic predecessors.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think that would make a difference to their claims, though?
Well, see, the interesting thing is the Egyptian claim is actually not based on sort of a cultural or ancestry claim, like we've discussed in previous episodes. In fact, if you look back on our records, we discussed the ownership of land in episode 93, and this has some very important parallels. But Egypt's claim this time is not based on an appeal to culture or tradition, but rather that the bust was uncovered within Egypt's sovereign's borders. So their claim is basically stolen property, so much as a cultural icon. And documents that were uncovered in 1924 that were within the archives of the German Oriental Company recalls the January 20th, 1913 meeting between Ludwig Borchardt and a senior Egyptian official to discuss the division of the archaeological finds of the 1912 expedition in Egypt. According to the secretary, the German archaeologist, quote, wanted to save the bust for us. And there's all these sort of rumors that he, like, wrapped it in paper and didn't tell anyone about it, or said it was, oh, it's just an ugly piece of pottery or something, all these kind of weird rumors. In fact, Time magazine even listed as among the top most plundered artifacts. This is interesting because it's not really a claim about cultural heritage so much as it is a claim about this is a piece of stolen property. Dr. Zahi Hawass of the Egyptian Council for Antiquities believes that Nefertiti belongs to Egypt and that the bust was taken out of Egypt illegally and should therefore be returned. He has maintained that the stance of the Egyptian authorities were misled over the acquisition of Nefertiti in 1913, and he has demanded that Germany prove that it was exported legally. And again, typical of land claims is that they often apply to things like, you know, well, our ancestors lived here for many years, or, you know, our culture produced such and such. And those are very hard claims to prove. I mean, how do you define what your culture is and define it in the sense that it's uniquely yours. Just like ancestry. I mean, as we talked about ancestry, we're all really ancestors. And how do you determine which ancestry is more important? So the neat thing I find is that because Egypt is making this claim on a more legal basis, I think Germany is in kind of a bit of a crux here. They are legally obligated to either prove, you know, here are the documents that indicate this statue or this bust was removed from the country in good faith, or they may actually have a problem here.
I guess there's two things I'd think about it. One, the idea of statute of limitations.
Quite literally.
Yeah. But the other thing is, if we run with the assumption that this is a artifact of cultural importance to humanity, I mean, we are talking something that's thousands and thousands and thousands of years old.
Absolutely.
The same thing with, I think it's the Elgin reliefs, which are the parts of the Parthenon that England took from Greece and are now in London. The idea that, you know, let's say that the bust belongs to Egypt. Does that necessarily mean it should go back to Egypt? And I think it's ironic that it happens to be Egypt, considering what's going on there right now, that in some senses, taking some artifacts out of their natural setting and putting them someplace that's more stable and more protected might actually be a good thing. Of course, ironically enough, I guess, when he took this, he didn't know about World War One and World War Two, which actually probably meant it was safer in Egypt until more recent times. Mm-hmm. But do you think that things that are of, you know, cultural significance to humanity, that, you know, even if you acknowledge ownership to a particular country, that the location for safekeeping should be at a third party that is safe at the moment?
Well, you know, this reminds me of a really good documentary that I saw recently called The Rape of Europa. And it's all about how famous works of art were protected from the Nazis during World War II. And all these like really kind of heroic efforts to move these huge pieces of artwork into like basements and, you know, shelters during the war. I think that certainly these works of art and cultural heritage, they're not just owned by the culture that produced them. They're owned by humanity, and they should be enjoyed by humanity. I'm going to sound like Indiana Jones at some point here. But they belong in a museum. And, I mean, where that museum is, that's really hard to say.
And I would even go so far as to say I don't even have a problem that the people who are responsible, who govern the exhibit, could be the nationals, right? So even though that might be housed in the German Museum of Culture, it may be governed by the Egyptians, and they say who gets to see it, how it's stored. I mean, like, I'm not trying to say that just because you're Egyptian, you're not smart enough to know how to keep it. It's just, like, right now, physically, it's not. Another great example was Iraq. I mean, how many historical artifacts to humanity were lost or destroyed because it was an unstable area?
Absolutely. And, in fact, I even heard a report that during the Egyptian uprising, people broke into the museum and damaged some priceless artifacts. And, I mean, that's just, I really feel bad about that. There were claims that, oh, it was actually, you know, government officials went in there to tarnish. Who cares? Priceless artifacts have been destroyed. I mean, like, just don't destroy a priceless artifact. Leave them alone. They belong to everybody, and, you know, they should be enjoyed by everybody. If Egypt, you know, I know for a fact Egypt actually does have very good ability to display its artifacts. The Egyptian Museum is top notch. The one thing that I did notice was that they were saying in this case the bust of Nefertiti is very fragile, might not survive transportation. In that case, maybe some kind of special arrangement could be made. But again, these artifacts, they only exist if you take care of them, and you know. They have so much teaching potential. They have so much awe-inspiring potential. I think that we really need to figure out a way that these can be, in some cases, repatriated if necessary, but by all means, displayed and enjoyed by the public.
Exactly.
Well, why don't we take another commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? We'll come back. We're going to discuss science and imperialism, which actually kind of fits in with this whole discussion, doesn't it?
It does.
All right. Well, stay tuned.
Hey, This is Kim.
Kim. And we're the Three Sets. You're listening to CITR on 101.9. That was smooth.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Freethinker, episode 100. We're talking about science and imperialism. Why science and imperialism, Don?
Well, a friend of mine asked me if it wasn't true that science, Western science, is really just part of the whole colonial baggage that is intended and used to diminish local, in quotes, indigenous knowledge and elevate the superiority of Western ways of thinking. Of course, as a believer in science, I knew he was wrong. But then again, as an even better skeptic, I thought, well, maybe I should examine the question. To start out with, I should point out there's different ways to look at this question. First is the idea that science made Western domination possible. Then there's the fact that science may be neutral, but scientists aren't. And then lastly, there's this idea that's called scientism. Now, it is a fact, or at least a quirk of history, that Europe took knowledge and technology from other cultures, altered and improved many, and eventually applied them to world exploration and then domination. Europe didn't invent gunpowder, but it did perfect its use as a weapon. They didn't invent oceanic travel, but they did develop the technology of shipbuilding and navigation to the point of not only circumnavigating the globe, but to do so regularly. Now, I don't really want to get into the why or even the how Europe did this expropriation of technology. They weren't the first imperial power. They're probably not going to be the last imperial power. But they were, however, the first global power. Now, there is a paradox in colonialism and how science was able to both create and destroy civilizations. One of the greatest crimes, and I'm going to use the word crime here, of that Europeans committed, at times accidental, at others on purpose, against indigenous population, was the spread of disease. However, through plagues and medicine, science was fundamental to Europe's ability to dominate. Science caused the loss of many indigenous cultures while creating an entire new one for Europeans and those people they dominated. Now, when we say that science enabled European domination, the first thing I'd look at is the idea of science of transportation. Not only did it allow Europeans to travel around the globe and encounter new people in new lands, but to take with them, unknowingly, a plethora of diseases from one continent to the other. Ironically, because of the endless waves of plagues and disease that ravaged Europe, also due to scientific advances in trade and travel within that area, Europe became a reservoir of biological weapons like smallpox, but it also became one of the leading areas of the science of how to deal with these plagues, like things like vaccinations. Mm-hmm. When Europe first encountered indigenous people, local medicine was only really adapted to local conditions, which would add very little experience with highly communicable diseases. Because if you had a highly communicable disease in, like, a tribal situation, usually the tribe just disappeared, and that was the end of it. Mm-hmm. In Europe, it was a different sort of thing. Europeans, like I say, thanks to the extensive Euro-Asian trade, were much better equipped biologically, as in natural immunity, as well as culturally, because they'd gone through, like, the Black Death and those sort of things, to deal with new communicable diseases when they encountered them, like dengue fever and the such. Thus, indigenous people died by the millions, whereas the Europeans only died by the hundreds, maybe thousands. The irony to this, that science had first enabled Europeans to infect and decimate indigenous populations. Then, thanks to ever-increasing medical advances, a number of them spurred by the challenges to overcome new diseases in new lands, provided the salvation for the locals to save them from the very diseases the Europeans introduced.
And, you know, I'd also point out that, you know, science in many cases was held back in Europe by a lot of religious dogma. You know, you look at just like Galileo as a perfect example, but even the advent of germ theory, which would lead to vaccinations and medical treatments that would ultimately save the world, was held back by dogma that had been in place for centuries. And in many cases, you know, the solutions to the plagues that were going on was right there waiting to be found, but no one thought to even consider questioning the pre-scientific views at the time.
Yeah, well, you know, and actually we'll get more into this when we talk about scientist bias. But ironically, like, everyone talks about how Europe thought the world was flat. Well, officially, the world was flat, and officially, the Earth was the center of the universe. But practical people, people who actually went out and sailed and actually sort of did it 9 to 5, knew better. And even if they said, well, it's you know, it's a fiction if we pretended the Earth was round, but it works.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of times, practicality often outweighed what was known scientifically.
And I mean, the fact that a lot of authorities had a vested interest in appearing right. So they didn't like the idea of scientists coming along and saying, well, actually, you know, the world is flat, and actually, you know, the Earth is not the center of the universe. A lot of them would just kind of be like, well, we know, but don't say it too loudly, you know.
Well, we're going to get into that in 1 second. But the last little bit that I had for how science enabled Europe to dominate, and I mean, again, this is really whacked if you think about it, is that Europeans ultimately sort of became cast as both the takers of lives, again, thanks to smallpox and that, but also the saviors of life because of Western medicine that not only allowed them to take on the idea that they were somehow gods and somehow superior, but also instilled in locals a sense of inferiority because they couldn't do this. You couple that with the idea that this give and take of science had its parallels in areas like agriculture, mining, manufacturing, and a great number of areas. One of the most notable of the other areas is the area of warfare. I mean, first, it allowed Europeans to dominate local powers with guns and cannons, but then it flipped over and provided the means for the locals, usually those friendly to the Europeans, to dominate their own rivals and to actually fight back. So, you know, and there's also another thing, too. You know, I mean, once Europe became rich from the New World, it then could turn its sight on the old cultures like China and India and all that, right? And it then could, it wasn't so much science that allowed it to dominate, although that did help a lot, but just sheer force of power because it had the resources.
And also choice, too. China was, in many cases, centuries ahead of the West in technology, but they just never became imperial. And there were, if you look at Chinese history, there are instances where they do become imperial, and then the next regime comes along and just stops it cold in its tracks. I mean, there are quite a few interesting stories about that. So, I mean, you also had the will to expand one's powers and borders that you saw in Europe at the time.
Yeah. But, okay, so that's enough of about the how. Now, another idea is that science itself is actually a tool of domination. Now, what do we mean when we say that? Well, what I mean essentially is that not only the fruits of science have allowed imperialism, which we've already discussed, but the idea that it can be used to reinforce that dominance. This is done really in two ways. First, local knowledge, for example, herbalism, was seen as backwards and primitive, and that the only real medicine would be found in a test tube. Another way it's done is, or perhaps misused, whatever, is that science is used to sort of reinforce dogmas that, you know, some things are seen as natural because science says so. One of the big examples I'm trying to get at in this one is the quote-unquote biological proof that whites were superior to blacks, which was used so much. Another good example of this is the whole Piltdown Man fraud. Now, for those of you who don't know about Piltdown Man, in 1912, the missing link, in quotes, was found in England by Charles Dawson. Now, its ready acceptance by the scientific community was allowed because it fit with the cultural prejudice at the time. England was the superpower, was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, and was the ruler of billions of people around the globe. It was obvious, at least for those at the time, that England would have been the birthplace of intelligence. It also conformed to the assumption at the time that brains drove evolution of the body, i.e. you had big brains first with ape bodies, and then big brains with human bodies. Notably, the jaw of Piltdown Man was ape-like, but had a human brain. But the science method always seems to rule out, because it keeps moving on. By the late 20s, there were a number of discoveries, such as Peking Man and Song Child, which showed that actually it was the human body that evolved first, and then the brain. By 1930, Piltdown Man was seen as best an anomaly, and at worst a fraud. And it was proven as a fraud by the 40s, where they had better techniques to dating. Another great example of this whole idea of science sort of demeaning non-Western thought is in the area of herbalism, which, again, the scientific method has kind of proven over. Because one of the greatest growth areas in pharmaceutical is the discovery of nature's pharmacy, that created by evolution in plants and animals. Modern science is checking out, you know, rainforest plants and all that to see what chemicals are there to help fight infections. Remedies that were quite often known, albeit anecdotally, by local medicine men, as well as a lot of things that didn't help.
Right. And I would even go so far as to say that the notion of characterizing science as like a tool for domination is a straw man argument that is, you know, saying, you know, well, it's sort of like saying like a hammer. You can use a hammer to build a house. You can use a hammer to hit someone over the head. As you said, science actually does look very closely at quote-unquote herbalism. It's investigating rainforests. It's investigating, you know, natural poisons and venoms to discover antibodies. It is urgently engaged in the investigation of nature that way. Ultimately, I think it's kind of a silly argument to make that it's out there to crush these things under the heel of, you know, Big Pharma or something.
Exactly, but there is, I don't want to say a grain of truth, but you can kind of understand where they're coming from. Sorry, I'm going to switch to my whisper voice now.
Yeah, you can understand because they had a vested interest in dominating, but it's not like, you know, the third point on the scientific method is dominates, you know, other cultures. You can take science, just like you can take hammers, for instance, and use them to dominate or subject someone else.
Well, actually, and where I was going to go with this is that we need to distinguish between the scientific method and scientist, and how the scientific method eventually defeats the prejudice that scientists will honestly have, because scientists do have prejudice, and they do bring that to the table.
They are human, now, after all.
You know, one of the great one of the great examples of the corrective nature of the scientific method is in the area of race. Science once showed and proved that whites were at the top of the biological tree of humanity. However, in attempting to affirm previous generations' results, assumptions, and predictions, the scientific method began to show new generations the holes in the old theories, and that they had to adjust the theories to match the evidence. They had to abandon, however slowly and reluctantly, the cultural biases in the light of scientific evidence. Now, what do we mean by scientific method? In this context, I really see it as three parts. One, which most of you will know, it's the idea of you observe the world, you create a model of the world that predicts outcomes, you test those predictions, you adjust the model based on the test, and repeat. Now, the second part is a commitment to follow the evidence. Now, this is where scientists quite often will actually fail. Well, not often, occasionally fail. Part of the method is the willingness to accept the fact that given sufficient evidence, any and all beliefs, theories, or models may be wrong and need to be adjusted to match reality, even if that means abandoning long-held ideas like racism. Now, the last element that's not often acknowledged, but I think is an integral part, is the idea of intellectual competition. The driving need of all scientists to expand the boundaries of knowledge. That's one of the whole purposes of being a scientist. For those who say that once a scientific idea becomes established, it cannot be challenged, misses this integral concept. Every up-and-coming scientist wants to make a name for himself in the field and to gain the immortality of contributing to the project of human knowledge. To that end, one of the best ways to gain his immortality is to prove the old ways of thinking wrong, to prove an established model is either incomplete or incorrect. This means that every generation of scientists, by their very nature, challenges everything that has become, quote-unquote, dogma in scientists and are, when successful, rewarded greatly. So this is the idea that even when scientists themselves may fail and they may go to their local prejudice, the scientific method itself, because it is neutral, it doesn't care about your prejudice, eventually will correct the errors of the individuals who may be practicing it.
Absolutely.
Now, the last area, and this one I guess I'll go over quickly, is the idea of scientism. This is often used as a derogatory term, especially towards skeptics. The idea is that science itself is a dogma, that the only truth and the only way to find capital T truth is in and with science. Now, this criticism is in some ways, I think, a straw man. It's true that most scientists and skeptics believe that science is the best way to know the truth. But it doesn't mean that they believe science can, in actuality, be applied, or at least applied perfectly, to every question man may ask. On a recent episode, we discussed the role of science in ethics. One of the points that came out was the idea that if science could, with the same accuracy, certainty, and predictability found in physics, for example, be applied to ethics, then it could provide all the answers. But however, it was also reiterated that at least for now and probably forever, science could not achieve this level of knowledge, and that in the gaps, often very large gaps, the traditions of philosophy and discussion have their place, that because of the complexities of the human mind and society, the role of science may be quite limited when it actually comes to some of these big questions. This, however, doesn't mean that we should try to apply science and acknowledging its limitations and try to limit the number of inaccuracies and uncertainties so as to allow, you know, a better foundation for the philosophical questions, for the big questions. So, to answer my friend's question that we sort of started this journey on, is science a tool of imperialism? No. The technology it produces has been used for that purpose, but it could have been used for any others. Ethan was mentioning a hammer. That even when scientists reinforce cultural superiority, the scientific method will eventually bring down that house of cards. And that although we may have a belief, well, maybe in a faith, that science can answer all the questions, it's a healthy belief because we also acknowledge that science has its limitations, and we're not, it's not a dogmatic belief. It's a belief based on the evidence at hand.
Absolutely. Let's go to our last commercial break. We have a special dispatch from our former co-host Rob, then our skeptical highlights, and then we're out of here. So stay tuned, folks.
Theater at UBC presents the world premiere of Double Double Foil and Fumble, a farcical, intelligent, whirlwind play written by MFA candidate Rem Hanman and directed by Hersey Innit. Double Double Foil and Fumble follows the story of five friends who get together to weave some magic, only none of them know what they're doing, half of them don't believe in magic, and some of them have ulterior motives. Add in some gender-bending reality shifts and you've got yourself a fabulous evening in the theater. Admission is by donation, with all proceeds going to Positive Space at UBC. Double Double Foil and Fumble plays February 9th to the 12th in the Dorothy Somerset Studio on UBC campus. Showtime is 7:30 p.m., 6:30 on February 11th.
Traveler. Hello, I'm Rob, cognitive psychologist and traitor to our country. Recently, I left Canada to pursue a career in academia in England, which, as we've seen, is just the opposite of what those stodgy imperialists want. They try to spread science via the colonies and to take over the world with their order and explaining things. Well, I've decided to show them what we think of that by packing up and invading their country with science and see how they like it. So far, this has only resulted in my getting a job as a research assistant, but I'm sure they'll have the Brits shaking in their boots soon enough. In any case, I most certainly haven't sold out and started spying on your activities to tell the Queen what you're up to. No, sir. But really, congratulations on reaching 100 episodes of carefully and entertainingly presented shows. Here's to 100 more.
Tune in next week for another dispatch from a skeptical traveler.
Thanks, Rob. That was fantastic. I look forward to hearing more of your skeptical dispatches. Well, let's go on to our skeptical highlights, and we've got a couple of good ones. A theme in our skeptical highlights. The first one I'm going to mention is the 1023 challenge. This is a follow-up to the overdose that was staged by the 1023 campaign in 2011, which originated in the UK. This time, we have an international event in more than 10 countries, and more than 23 cities will gather over the weekend of February 5th to 6th, 2011, to make the simple statement, homeopathy, there's nothing in it. Of course, in Vancouver, we'll be meeting outside the art gallery on the Robson side for a dilution and overdose at 11 a.m. Saturday the 5th. This will be a follow-up to our own appearance on CBC Marketplace. So, you know, watch the episode or then come overdose with us. And in fact, you can watch the episode of Marketplace where we overdosed with the SFU skeptics, because they're planning their own homeopathy overdose Friday on the 4th at 10 a.m. in Convo Mall at SFU. They're going to show the episode of Marketplace, so go join them, watch the episode, and then come with us, meet outside the art gallery, and let's make a statement about homeopathy.
I was going to use a homeopathic recipe, but of course, it was just going to be corn squeezings instead of water. That would work, wouldn't it?
Well, I think you need to, like, actually bottle your throat illness and then dilute it repeatedly.
Oh, yes. No. Okay.
Well, this has been our 100th episode of Radio Free Thinker. My thanks to my fellow co-host Don for making it in, even though he's clearly close to dying.
And my thanks for Ethan for putting up with my wonderful voice. And to all our listeners out there who've been with us for 100 episodes and will be with us for 1,000 more, I am sure. It's been a lot of fun making them, and we hope to continue to make them from now into the future. Please send us your input, both positive and negative. No, just positive, to radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
And check out our webpage at www.radiofreethinker.com for all the blogs and show notes you could possibly want. And until next week, see you then, folks.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.